Hello, everyone. Welcome back to our fourth and final episode in this Resident Evil miniseries on Tales of the Lesser Medium. Today's episode covers the happenings of Resident Evil Zero. And as always, we are warning you that we spoil the story completely. We spoil it by giving it all away, and we spoil it further by interrupting it with obnoxious jokes and skits. I'm Caleb J. Ross, joined by my co-host, Travis Terry. Say hello, Travis.
Hello, Travis. Once again, this series on Resident Evil will cover only 1, 2, 3, and 0. We'll circle back around later for other entries in the series. If you're curious about when more episodes of the show will come out, there's no schedule. These things take some time to put together, so once we have another chunk ready, we'll ship them out. And please, if you have not already, rate and review this show if you've stuck around this long. It will help us out. Reach out to us on Twitter if you'd like, at Tales Lesser. We got a Twitter thing for this now, so.
It's fancy.
Yes, indeed.
I'm guessing Lesser Tales was taken.
Didn't try it. It was a good idea, though. Maybe I should switch it around.
No, it's fine. I was just being a jackass. Getting started off early in this episode, being a jackass. All right, let's get down to business. Off the bat, a text scroll mentions three notable locations. The first you should be very familiar with, Raccoon City, labeled a Midwestern town in America. Next, Rockfort Island, labeled a solitary island far off in the sea. And Sheena Island, an island said to become the second Raccoon City. Three unrelated but intensely traumatic events occurred in these locations, and it is believed that the International Enterprise Umbrella is responsible. But little is known about the origin of the Faceless Corporation. The introduction goes on to say that Resident Evil Zero will dive deeper into the truths of what happened prior to the mansion incident of Resident Evil 1. Who is Umbrella? How was the T-Virus created, and why? Cut to a passenger train careening down the tracks through Raccoon City the night of July 23rd, 1998, nearly 2 full months before Jill and Chris ever enter the mansion in Raccoon City. One of the passengers, a sharply dressed gentleman sitting by himself, hears a noise that draws his attention outside the window. The noise sounds wet and squishy. Suddenly, basketball-sized fleshy blobs strike the window and stick, exposing jagged teeth to the frightened passengers. Eventually, the entire side of the train car is covered with them, and their force breaks open the glass. Passengers scream and flee as the creatures attack, clinging to any exposed flesh they can find. Faces, necks, arms, legs. The train continues onward, unfazed, through the Raccoon Forest. Meanwhile, atop a nearby rocky crag overlooking both the forest and neighboring Raccoon City stands a pale man in white robes who appears to be watching and taking delight in the massacre on the train.
And his name was Eric Trump.
Now, that sounds like it sucks, but you know what? Finally, they bring in another single-syllable last name into this game. Ada Wong's not all by herself anymore. I appreciate that. So, 2 hours later, a STARS helicopter flies over Raccoon Forest, conducting a surveillance run while investigating some bizarre murders that recently took place in the suburbs outside the city. They had no idea what they were up against, and nothing they had ever been trained for gave them a chance to survive. What happens next? Aboard the flight is the Bravo team, consisting of...
Oh no, are you going to harp on these syllables again?
Just the fact that you're asking about it means that my constant talking about it is making an impact. So yes, I am going to.
Fuck!
Enrico Marini, Richard Aiken, Kenneth Sullivan, Ed Dewey, Forrest Speyer, and new recruit Rebecca Chambers. Now, if you listen to our first episode, a number of these names should sound familiar. And you may also notice not a single syllable last name among them, except Eric Trump. Thank you, Eric Trump. Okay. Is that the message of this episode?
No. You know, they were talking about how the... So we know that they're on the way to the city. They don't know what to expect. They've been trained for anything, but not specifically this thing. But I wonder what they were expecting. Like, all right, we got some bizarre murders going down here in this forest, this little city. My money's on disgruntled cat lady. She's upset her landlord. Keep your eyes peeled. Cat women, they're nothing to take lightly. They have disheveled hair, big claws, and God, you should see their brooms.
Do you know the old why witches ride brooms? Do you know why that is?
No, I don't.
Okay, quick aside here. This is documented fact. This isn't hearsay. This isn't lore. This is actually what happened. So women who would, like crazy witch women who would like practice like magic, and they'd get really high on like cocaine and stuff, right? But because they were kind of dirty most of the time, they couldn't apply cocaine into their body because they would infect themselves because of their fingernails and stuff were just gross. So they would apply cocaine and heroin and such to their broom handles and ride them.
Huh.
Yeah, that's real. That's documented. So anyway, listener, stick around for us. We're going to talk about more fun stuff.
Wow.
But just keep that in your mind.
And here I was thinking, I'm probably going to cut out that cat lady thing because I didn't think it was funny. But then you go and top it with pussy broom cocaine.
You can still just keep the part I said in and just have it just out of nowhere. Suddenly, the helicopter issues an alarm indicating engine failure, forcing the pilots to perform an emergency landing in the middle of the raccoon forest. The helicopter cuts through the trees and touches down to the ground, spinning itself around. But all in all, the landing is a success. In the way, I suppose, that functional gravity is the main factor in a successful landing. So yeah, very successful. The team exits the chopper to spot an overturned military police vehicle. As the team approaches, they find the vehicle's former occupants strewn around, their faces twisted with pain, all deceased. There's a gooey, slimy substance trickling down the side of the vehicle. None of the team notices it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure there was someone who noticed it. Like, Kenneth runs up panting. Hey, guys, look. I know none of us investigated these corpses very closely. I mean, especially me, as we can all agree, I don't like corpses.
The way you offered up that information unprovoked is a bit concerning, Kenneth, but okay.
Seriously, of all the people here, I'm the least excited by corpses. I mean, when I see a corpse, I'm like, ew, gross, I would never touch or poke or kiss a corpse.
Wait, what?
Or even look at it.
Okay.
Or definitely not climax all over it. Not me. They called me Corpse Hater Kenneth in school. That's how much I would not ejaculate on a corpse.
Oh my God, someone ejaculated all over these corpses.
Oh my God, did you hear Rebecca? Who could have done that? Oh, my money's on Richard. Did you know he wants finger banged a taxidermied wolf?
Oh, Richard.
I don't like Kenneth. I don't like him. I don't like Kenneth.
It's a lot of semen out of that guy.
Rebecca Chambers spies a clipboard on the ground and learns what the vehicle was up to. Evidently, the police were transporting a former lieutenant to be court-martialed. His name is Billy Cohen, a 26-year-old who was set to be executed the day before. We'll get to why later, but it appears the prisoner was not among the dead near the vehicle, and Richard Aiken surmises that the prisoner must have caused the accident and killed the men to escape.
And ejaculated on the corpses, probably.
Kenneth.
Enrico orders everyone to separate and survey the area in search of Cohen.
I think Kenneth needs a timeout.
I think he does. You're right. He probably won't be coming back.
Coming back.
That wasn't
bitch.
Even intentional, but all right.
Son of a bitch.
While searching alone, Rebecca comes across the train, the Ecliptic Express. God, that's a hard name to market. Ecliptic Express.
Ooh.
At some point in the 2 hours since the attack from the game's opening, it has come to a complete stop on the tracks. More of the slimy goo can be seen dripping from the bottom of the train car she's approaching. She climbs on board and finds that everyone on the train seems obviously dead. However, she soon realizes, as is typical with Resident Evil, they aren't completely dead. Undead begin to stand and shamble toward her. Frightened, she shoots one in the head and exits the train car.
Man, this is why I'm terrified to pull any practical jokes. What if this was all a ruse and someone was going to eventually pop over a seat and say, "Happy birthday, Rebecca!" Or it was like a flash mob situation. Now she's killed one of them, so the rest are like, "Oh shit, okay, seriously, don't move, guys." Did not see that coming. Did not see that coming.
It reminds me of the very first episode of Reno 911, a show I love and will forever love.
Mm-hmm.
The very first episode, the opening scene, it's sort of almost the pre-credits sort of intro. The team is called to a residence that ends up being a surprise party for one of the officers, but the panic causes one of the officers to get shot, and that officer is never in another episode. The show never addresses it. And I always thought it was really funny because it sets the perfect tone for that series. None of these characters actually care about each other or like one another, and that's kind of its thing. I love it.
Yeah, man. I love that. I miss that show so much. It was one of my favorites.
Very much so. I agree.
I actually, my wife, when our first date was a Halloween date, and we dressed up, and I went as Lieutenant Dangle, and I had a fake mustache and short shorts, and realized that compared to everyone else at this thing, I had gone all out, and it was very embarrassing.
But she stuck with you, and that's how you knew. That's how you knew she was the one.
That was before our first breakup. There were several. I do blame the Dangle for that, too. I haven't dangled in front of her since.
Well, I don't know. Your kid would argue otherwise. Rebecca needs a key to access the conductor's office and engine room. While searching for the key, she comes across some papers that indicate at least some of the passengers on the train were a part of a cleanup crew that were headed to an undisclosed and previously abandoned location.
Well, it's a train, so it's pretty easy to figure out where it was going to go, I think.
That's true. Eventually, she finds a train employee dead on the ground and searches his body for a key. But while searching, she hears footsteps approach from behind her. She stands and turns to see who she recognizes as Billy Cohen, pointing a gun at her. She identifies him by name, recognizing him from the pictures she saw on his transport documents from the overturned van. He responds, "So you seem to know me. Been fantasizing about me, have you?" She tells him she's aware of his situation, and he soon realizes that she's a member of STARS. He stops pointing the gun at her and turns to walk away, but she chases after him and nervously tells him that he's under arrest. She's still a rookie on her first mission, after all. He's unfazed by her, shows her he's already wearing handcuffs on one of his wrists, and he continues walking.
Wow.
Now that is incredibly badass. He has not only broken out of custody once, but he's too badass to remove the other handcuff. And he's so badass, he flaunts his badassness in front of a cop. I like this guy so far.
Yeah.
A second later, Edward Dewey, two syllables, one of her Bravo squad mates, crashes through a window and lands inside the train. He's clearly injured and looks like he's been mauled by wolves. He's short of breath, but tells Rebecca that there are zombies and monsters outside the train. He goes quiet, and she tries to wake him, but is interrupted by a pair of undead dogs who crash in from the windows above, evidently still after Edward. She shoots them both dead and turns her attention back to Edward. She soon realizes she can't help him and decides to go after Cohen.
Edward? Edward, why are those dogs after you?
I have no idea.
Are you being 100% honest with me, Edward?
Of course! Why wouldn't I be honest with you?
Well, you do have a history of stealing puppies from dogs.
Okay, come on! That was just that 7 times. And, hey, and I only do that when the puppies are really cute, okay? Mm-hmm. But these puppies from those undead zombie dogs, don't tell them, but those puppies are ugly.
So you did check those dogs for puppies.
But I wasn't going to steal them.
Edward, is there a puppy in your pocket?
A puppy? No, there's not a puppy.
He's just going to train them to be police dogs. That makes sense.
That's all.
Enrico tries to reach Rebecca on her radio as she's making her way through the lifeless and dark train in search of Cohen. Enrico tells her that they have intel on the fugitive. Apparently, he was court-martialed for the murder of up to 23 people and was recently institutionalized. Enrico warns her that Cohen is extremely dangerous and wouldn't hesitate to kill her. Which I find interesting, because Billy Cohen has already had a gun to her head, and he, in fact, did hesitate to pull the trigger. So the sub-narrative here is that Rebecca's own squad is less truthful, or at least less informed than Billy, so she's kind of right to side with Billy for this whole thing.
That's a good point.
That's deeper storytelling than Resident Evil's ever done before. So I'm willing to chalk that up to accident.
Oops.
Moments later in the dining car, Billy sneaks up behind Rebecca again and tells her it's going to be dangerous from here on out and that they should work together. Rebecca doesn't take kindly to the proposition, but Billy tells her very condescendingly, calling her a little girl, that there are some freaked out things on the train, and he wants to make it out alive. She tells him she doesn't want his help and that she can handle this on her own and that she doesn't appreciate being called a little girl. Billy, continuing to condescend Rebecca, says he'll wait while she takes care of everything.
Yeah, then like not 30 seconds later, he's like, "Hey, Rebecca, have you seen my red sweatshirt? I can't find it."
Rebecca leaves Billy behind and enters the dining car, where she spots an old man in a ragged suit sitting alone. And he doesn't appear to be a zombie. He does, however, look in shock. He stares blankly toward the ground. Rebecca approaches him and touches his shoulder.
Excuse me, sir?
His head slowly turns to face her with a creaking sound, and eventually it falls off his neck and onto the floor, where it bursts open into leech-like creatures that scurry together and form a large, glistening mass that then forms a human-like body with the old man's face and blank, white eyes.
Whoa!
Excuse me, sir? I'm going to have to ask you to leave this Denny's?
Fine, but 2 stars on Yelp.
The creatures then move in unison across the floor toward Rebecca and overwhelm her, covering her entire body. Billy arrives just in time and shoots at the creatures. At the sound of the shots, the leeches scatter from Rebecca's body. A few fall to the floor where she kneels, gasping. Billy approaches to check on her, but as he does, some of the leeches leap up toward his face. He dives out of the way, shooting them out of midair as he does. The rest of the leeches slowly slither out of sight.
He totally shoots her after she's covered in leeches. I wonder if he knew that was Rebecca under all those suckers, or if he just shot at it, and when they scattered, he was like, whoa, okay, I'm lucky she was wearing a vest. Also, they don't react to what just happened. They were both just kind of like, damn, train leeches. I've only ever seen these things on TV.
Hey, welcome back to The Tonight Show. We have Australian wildlife expert Steve Irwin here today. What do you got in this tank here, Steve?
Hello, mate. These are Tasmanian train leeches, here. Zoom in close there, mate. Look at them square.
Ooh.
These little blokes here, they hang out in trains and when threatened, will form into the shape of a man and attack you by enveloping your whole.
Oh, my God, that's remarkable. For our viewers out there, tell us if you're attacked by one of these things, what should you do?
Oh, that'd be a right grim situation there, Caleb. But if you have a pal nearby, have them shoot just one of them.
Oh. Is that right? Just one?
Mate, I don't want to do it, mate. Shoot one of the leeches and they'll all run away. Freddy pusses the little sucks on.
I like how Steve Irwin also assumes everyone just has a gun.
Yeah, pretty much.
Billy asks Rebecca how she's doing. The camera pans up to show the pale man in white robes on the hillside from the game's intro. He's apparently been watching our heroes the entire time. How long has he been watching them? Who is he? Suddenly, the train begins to lurch forward and is on the move again. Billy and Rebecca are both confused by this. Who is operating the train? Billy tells Rebecca to go to the first engine car to see, and then tells her that they need to start cooperating. She reluctantly agrees, but vows to shoot him if he tries anything funny. He seems okay with that and gives her a box of ammo to help her on request to the front of the train.
Jeez, these games and their lack of commitment to the banding together bit, it's like, get up there and see who's driving the train. Wait, what are you doing? Get your ass back here. We need to stick together. Thank you. Damn. Now go to the rear car and pull the brake. Hey, where the fuck are you going? You stay right here with me. Are you nuts? Hey, go find my red sweatshirt all by yourself.
I also like the line, don't try anything funny, because my like weird director brain would be like in a romantic comedy. If this were happening, if it was like a horror romantic comedy, he'd like turn away and then he'd come back with like a clown nose and be like this? You mean like this? Don't do this? Is that what you're saying? Don't do this.
She fucking blows his brains out.
That's a way better ending than the happy, like they go on a date and marry that I was thinking of. Yeah, that's better.
We need to invent the romantic horror comedy. That's what we, I don't know if that's as common.
Huh.
That could be our thing.
You're right. Okay, I'll get on this immediately. To pass through the train's automatic doors, Rebecca needs to reconnect the power. She spots a ladder at the back of the engine train and makes her way to the roof of the train to power the coupling that's been roughly severed. After reconnecting it, she sees slime overtake the power controls. She stares at it puzzled before the slime bursts forward and powerfully knocks her from the roof of the train and into the kitchen car.
Kenneth strikes again!
He did come back. I was wrong. Luckily, she spots a dumbwaiter that she uses to transport the key out of the kitchen car and out to Billy, who can now reach the lower floor of the kitchen and conductor's office. Here he finds a briefcase he can't open and a ladder leading up to the bar. In the bar, Billy finds an ice pick, something he can use to unjam the kitchen door, and in one of the private bedrooms, he spies an old hunting shotgun. On his way back through the bar to give Rebecca the ice pick, a tremor causes the car to shake and chandeliers to detach from the ceiling and crash to the floor.
Suddenly, giant claws pierce through the roof, and a giant scorpion enters the claustrophobic space of the train. The scorpion, formerly known as Stinger by Umbrella, was being transported on the train but escaped containment when the train was attacked. Billy flees to the other end of the saloon car but is trapped. Using the shotgun, he eventually gets the scorpion to go down.
You know, that scorpion could have been the size of my palm, and I would have reacted the exact same way Billy did.
I agree with you on that. He meets back up with Rebecca in the kitchen, where they find a key to the briefcase. But they discover it requires two keys. Could have probably figured that out before.
Jeez.
Got all crazy with it. Then they make their way to the rear of the car, where Rebecca finds a grappling gun attached to the rear of the train, which she uses to climb back onto the roof.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's go to where the giant scorpion came from, in case there's more.
No, I think they're just Fallout players. They know a rad scorpion gland is worth quite a bit of money if you can sell it in town. She accesses a passenger cabin and finds the second key to the briefcase. Inside the briefcase, she finds the blue key card for the control room. But for the game Doom. It was really hard. Like, it's a hard game. Sorry. Stupid. Rebecca makes her way there. Once inside, she spots an armored soldier wearing a face mask. She ducks down and hides from view to eavesdrop. He's communicating on the radio with his commander and tells him that the Delta team has gained control of the train. Rebecca does not realize that the commander on the other end of the radio is Albert Wesker.
Ooh.
He's back, the one and only Albert Wesker from episode one.
I missed that guy.
Oh, he's back. It's going to be so much fun with him here. He brought his chemistry set.
Beside Wesker stands Dr. William Birkin. Together they are commanding the Delta team, but it's unclear where exactly they are. Birkin appears confused about how the T-virus leaked and was able to contaminate the lab, the mansion, and a train almost 3 miles away. Wesker doesn't care how it happened. He just wants it all to be covered up. He then orders the soldiers on the radio to destroy the train.
I imagine the soldier having no idea how to destroy a train he's currently on that's moving, just kind of staring down at his gun for a second thinking, so I guess I just shoot it. But he's too afraid to ask Wesker. But that's his only plan, is just to turn around on the train he's on and shoot it.
There's no other plan you could have. He's kind of between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah.
You know?
It's true.
Just as the soldier is responding, leeches spew from the wall of the train and consume the soldier. Another soldier rushes out to help, but is also devoured. Birkin and Wesker listen on in horror and confusion. Billy and Rebecca step over their bodies as they enter the control room. Once inside, they realize the train will imminently derail and crash if they don't stop it. Billy takes a keycard off the desk and runs to the back of the train to trigger the brake. Rebecca tells him to be careful and is left to wait in the hopes he succeeds. There's less than 2 minutes to spare. On the way toward the back of the train, Billy is attacked by former Bravo team member and current zombie Edward Dewey. Billy makes it to the rear and engages the brake, which also involves input from Rebecca up front. Once the brake is engaged, the train takes a while to stop with sparks flying from both sides, but the train is going too fast and crashes through a previously blocked off portion of the track. It flips onto its side and skids to a stop. Both Rebecca and Billy are ejected, but alive, now seemingly trapped in the tunnel.
Wow.
That's an awkward situation.
Yeah.
So here we are, just trapped in this tunnel. No way out.
Yeah.
Yeah. You hungry?
I'm hungry.
No, can you just help look for a way out?
No, I said I've done a cursory glance already, and I think we're here stuck forever. Look, this may seem like a weird question, but are you a runner?
What?
Like, do you exercise? You know, and what muscles do you exercise the most? I'm just curious.
Now's not the time to be hitting on me, Billy.
Oh, God, no, you gross. No, I'm gay. See, I'm just wondering if, like, we're starving and we have to eat each other. I'm just thinking about, like, how your body would taste. Like, I like a well-marbled steak, you know? So really, you don't have to lie to me about exercising. You know, the more fat, the better.
Look, there's a door over there.
Oh, good, great. Oh, well, I'm glad. I didn't have a plate or utensils anyway, so, you know, you can forget that whole eating you thing for now.
They spy a door that leads to a sewer tunnel nearby, which also has a ladder that leads up to a trapdoor. Once through, Billy and Rebecca find themselves in the front hall of a dimly lit mansion. The lights are on. Someone must live here, yet each step results in clouds of dust.
Looking down, they see an insignia on the ground with the words Umbrella Research Center below it. Rebecca slowly climbs the steps of the mansion and sees a picture on the wall. The face reminds her of a man she's seen before. She leaps back in horror. The name on the plaque below the picture reads, First General Manager, Dr. James Marcus. And she recalls that this face is the face of the man whom the leeches transformed into back on the train.
Wow. Leechman also is the most unsung member of the Justice League. Just because he's icky, not because he sucks.
But Leechman's presence is the only thing keeping like Aquaman sane. So sometimes a team needs a lightning rod, or at least like a rotating cast of a couple lightning rods.
That's true, man. Those that sea-dwelling Justice League altogether fairly unsung, if I might say so.
Yeah, a few more years of global warming, and they're going to be like the heroes we all need.
That's so true. That's true.
Rebecca and Billy have no idea they're being watched. Wesker and Birkin have a live feed into the mansion and are watching them from their surveillance rooms. Birkin wonders who they are, and Wesker recognizes Rebecca as a rookie member of STARS. Neither knows who Billy is. At this moment, a PA system broadcasts a message from Dr. James Marcus. He recites Umbrella's motto, Obedience breeds discipline. Discipline breeds unity. Unity breeds power. Power is life.
Okay, Hitler, that'll be enough.
Rebecca and Billy aren't the only ones confused by why this message is playing. As Birkin and Wesker look on at their monitors, the feed cuts to the robed man from the hillside, but he's now inside a control center somewhere nearby. As he speaks, they appear confused about who he is. He tells them he was the one who scattered the T-Virus in the mansion and train because he wants revenge on Umbrella. The man stands with his arms apart. Leeches come together in front of him as if by command. They form a human shape that Birkin recognizes as Dr. Marcus. The robed man says that 10 years ago, Birkin and Wesker helped assassinate James Marcus. It's clear he's out to avenge the doctor.
Wow, that's insane. But it also bothers me how villains in games and movies just seem to know how to like commandeer video feeds like they're Max Headroom. I got to think, though, if Robed Dude was around today, he'd just be a Twitch streamer. I could just see him practicing his speed runs of Kirby's Air Ride while chewing on a leech. Guys, remember to subscribe. Remember to subscribe. I'm here every Tuesday night and Wednesday night.
I'd watch that streamer.
Wouldn't be bad.
So, yeah. So who exactly was Dr. James Marcus? He was a virologist who pioneered 20th century viral weapons research. He was one of the founders of Umbrella Pharmaceuticals and was the director of its training center. Known to be a perfectionist, he became obsessed with his research and even started using children as his test subjects. There was a growing rift between him and his co-founder, Dr. Oswald Spencer, who wanted complete control of the company. He was assassinated in 1988, and as a cover-up to his actions, his body and those of his test subjects were dumped into an underground river channel.
Wow.
It's crazy, man. I can only imagine them not getting along too well. Like, yeah. We have Marcus here. He's a, why can't I use children as subjects, Spencer? Give me one good reason.
Well, for starters, they're children, Marcus. Innocent children.
No, you're going to preach to me about being considerate of children now.
Are you about to bring up Lisa again?
Yes, I'm bringing up Lisa, Trevor. Ugh. Don't you dare talk to me about...
You shut up, Marcus. We have orderlies play Scrabble with her every night and...
Oh, the ones in the blood-covered moo-moos. How many orderlies have died because you don't know how to use children as test subjects correctly?
That's not the part. We think 5. Maybe 6.
Oh, 5 or so. Oh, wow. Just 5 or 6. I thought it was more than that.
Feels like it, doesn't it?
Yeah, no doubt. I would have figured at least 10, maybe 12 dead orderlies.
Same. But we looked at the log and, yeah, it's less.
Oh, well, not bad then.
Thanks.
I like people that are mutually evil and can come to like a nice understanding. Yeah. You know, they're willing to admit when they're wrong. That's good people.
It's great.
Billy and Rebecca make it to the training center, but it appears occupied by zombies who were once the cleaning crew sent in to reopen the facility, but got the T-Virus. The front doors are blocked with a barricade, so they have to explore the house. They move through the house, killing zombies, including 2 more leech zombies, before getting to an area that looked to house large animals for experimentation.
After finding a key on the ground, the grate on the wall pops loose and startles Rebecca, who finds herself face to face with a massive, mutated centipede. It rises to show its many legs and the pincers on its mouth. It lunges at Rebecca and grabs her with its legs. She screams for Billy, who turns to find Rebecca in the clutch of the centipede, who has reared up and is holding her high off the ground. He shoots at its underside until it drops her to the floor and it flops down, dead.
Wow, that's crazy. And then Rebecca's like,
thanks, Billy. Oh, you know, if we get trapped down here, you could always eat that monster. You know, it's already dead, so...
Oh, no. See, arthropods don't have a high enough intelligence to comprehend leisure use of its musculature. Those things are all sinew and gristle. No, but you're still my top option, Becky. I see plenty of fat on you.
Hey! What a dick!
Will they or won't they? Billy and Rebecca manage to solve a few riddles that keep sections of the facility shut, even removing the barricades that prevent several doors in the mansion from opening. However, they still cannot leave the training facility due to the dilapidation of the bridge over a river several feet down. This makes the front exit a not option. They find a memo that implies an escape route in the observatory, so they head there. Once on the second floor, they find an office that once belonged to Dr. Marcus, but seems to now be occupied by a chess lover. There's a puzzle with giant chess pieces on the floor that Billy solves to open a secret compartment that hides Marcus's diary.
You know, chess doesn't seem like something Billy would know a lot about. It looks like he knows a lot about Five Finger Death Punch, but unless they had chess in prison, I don't know. But I was about to actually judge this office. I was like, how unrealistic is it for someone to love chess so much they just install like a giant chess board with giant chess pieces on the floor? But then I look around the room I'm in and it's like wall to wall, ceiling to floor with video games. I mean, I do kind of get it.
My biggest problem is that it's such a burden or deterrent to be motivated to write in your diary if you have to go through this crap to, like, get the diary out of a drawer. Like, you have to do all this crazy finagling just to get to the diary. Like, I could have my journal, like, in my hand with a pen, and I'm still like, nah, fuck it.
Not today. Not today. Dear diary, not today.
The diary is very old, but details the creation of a virus he refers to as the progenitor, and the synthesis of a second virus he refers to as T for tyrant. This was after he took the progenitor virus and mixed it with leech DNA. It seems as though all of Dr. Marcus's early experimentation involved leeches before he moved onto humans. He quips at the end of his notes that if anyone attempts to interfere with his work, they would become his next test subjects.
So this guy has a clear descent into madness.
Very much so. It goes a little something like this. So, dear diary, I just moved all the chess pieces out. I'm a little tired from doing all of that. So this will be short. Okay. I don't know if this is Marcus's voice, but this is what it's going to be this time. I'm not crazy. Dr. Marston's son needs to quit saying I'm crazy. Every single bring your kid to work day, here comes little Ralph Marston making fun of my animal testing. You tell me I'm crazy one more time, kid. I'll make you a freaking test subject. What did you say, little kid? Oh, haha, Dr. Fartkiss. Like, I've not heard that one before. My mom was calling me Fartkiss before you were even born. I bet you feel dumb now. Maybe next time you tell my leeches that they suck as test subjects, I'll bring you downstairs into the test chambers and start testing on you and your friends. Ooh. Then we'll see who sucks as a test subject. Oh, no, I get it now. Because leeches suck things. You're all right, Ralph Marston. But I'm still taking a Dremel bit to your cornea.
Yeah, wow.
Yours truly, Dr. Marston.
Always.
Marcus. Dr. Marcus.
He's always slow to the punch, but he'll eventually get it. He'll get a punchline.
Scientists have to evaluate everything before they arrive at a logical conclusion. It's just the way their brains work.
That's right.
The portrait of Marcus in the main hall reveals a secret door behind it. Rebecca and Billy pass through and down into the basement, where the two find a stone prison cell. They spot a nearby prisoner manifest that confirms this was Umbrella's detainment center for troublemakers and test subjects. There's an air vent with a grate hanging off that looks like Rebecca could pass through it. Billy hoists her up so she can reach, and as she falls through the other side, she plops down into a claustrophobic room with iron maidens and electric chairs as the only furniture, and a wall with various chains, whips, and other torture-like accoutrements. Mm.
It's a torture chamber. It also just so happens that the facility's circuit box is here, so Rebecca turns the power back on, which in turn shuts off a misting steam of boiling hot water in the boiler room that Rebecca and Billy can now pass through. The camera suddenly shifts to a view from security footage, where the strange caped man is menacingly watching Rebecca and remarks that she's now wasting her time, and because he has taken over the facility, she's trespassing. The camera view then creeps along the ground in a different area before a cage door is raised and a fanged and snarling beast is unleashed.
Ooh. Real quick, though, for those keeping count at home, that's the second underground kinky torture chamber and most likely sex dungeon in Resident Evil. The first being Chief Irons the Raccoon King's underground pleasure nest in the area below the police department. This proves something that I've always suspected. These diddle dungeons are everywhere, folks. Know when you smile at your neighbor and they smile back, they go back inside and poke around their own and their partner's nethers in a dark, damp, underground fuck lair so you can't hear them scream. Sorry, that's just a quick PSA, but, even the old ones, they might not use it anymore, but they got one down there.
I might say especially the old ones. At least in my headcanon, that's what's going on with all of my old neighbors.
Oh, yeah.
I think this also says a little bit about you. You write these scripts, and you did describe the Iron Maidens and the rest of the torture-like accoutrement as furniture, which seems like a very domestic description of those things.
Fair.
Yeah. You get them at IKEA. You have to navigate their maze of like hallways to get there, but it's worth it.
Can you imagine going through an IKEA and it's like, oh, that's a nice sunsetting fall set, and here's the summer set, and here's a dining set, and oh, what are we in now? What is this? Is this the fuck nest furniture room? This is crazy. I don't know how to get out of an IKEA, but I wish I could right now.
And it's like written in like Swedish or whatever, and it's like F umlauts over a U. K and then like a C, and you're like, is that fjuk nest? And the guy's like, no, it's fuck nest.
That's he's got one meatball hanging off the side of his face. Yeah, it's fuck nest. Get in here, guys.
That's like the ball gag in his gimp suit is just a meatball.
I want to go to Kinky IKEA.
Ikinka. As Rebecca slowly walks around the torture chamber, the beast, presumably the one we just watched become uncaged, leaps onto her back. It's a hostile baboon! It has massive claws and large exposed fangs, and it wants Rebecca dead. Luck is on her side, maybe, as she evades the hellish demonate by falling through the floor. This baboon chasing Rebecca is known as the Eliminator, which I got to imagine there's one scientist who really wanted that name.
The scientist is like, okay, so we've got a hostile baboon with massive claws. What should we name it?
The Eliminator.
Interesting. I was thinking something like Carl or Mr. Monkey, something fun. That way people are lulled by the cute name before being ripped to shreds.
No. The Eliminator. It's got to be the Eliminator. Because it eliminates all intruders. And because
why?
A side effect of the T-virus introduction is that the baboon now suffers nearly constant bouts of crippling and uncontrollable bowel-eliminating diarrhea.
Huh.
Yeah.
Listen, Dr. Marcus, answer me honestly, please.
Okay.
Did you intentionally fail to remove the diarrhea enzyme from the T-virus sample before injecting the baboon because you wanted more support for naming the subject, as you say, the Eliminator?
Yes.
You've got gumption, James. I like it. The Eliminator it is!
The Eliminator.
The Eliminator was an early prototype weapon developed exclusively by Dr. Marcus during his test phases of the T-virus. The baboon was used originally due to their intelligence, but it was found that as a result of the T-virus administration, there was a significant decline in their intelligence. After some time, the baboon idea was abandoned, and only a handful of specimens were retained for future testing. Marcus retrained his attention back on human subjects.
Thank God.
Back to Birkin and Wesker. The two are walking down a hallway of Birkin's private lab, and Birkin is reading through a clipboard and asks Wesker if what he's reading is really about the identity of the strange man in white robes who came over the video feeds earlier. Birkin seems surprised and declares, if it's true, if it is the man he's reading about, then Umbrella is finished. Wesker asserts that no matter what, if the conspiracy to expose Oswald Spencer's assassination of Marcus is revealed, that Wesker, Birkin, and Spencer's careers are all kaput.
Ooh, kaput!
Birkin says he's done with his T-virus research, but needs more time to perfect the more powerful G-virus. I don't think the G-virus really exists, but everybody keeps telling me it does. I don't know. I'll never find it. Wesker asserts that he needs more... That's stupid.
I think you're talking about this G-spot.
That explains why I'm so confused in that area.
Yeah.
Wesker asserts that he needs more combat data on the T-virus, and there's no better test subjects than the highly trained military task force of STARS. He intends to lure them in. Birkin tells Wesker he intends to activate the facility's self-destruct system to blow the whole joint into a mass of rubble to eliminate the strange man in white robes who has taken over and any evidence tying them to anything.
How many self-destruct buttons are in this compound? Every game so far ends in a giant explosion. The entire place is sitting on like a hot powder keg. It's a wonder it just doesn't explode in the middle of the night for no reason.
If I had infinite money and I could design a house with weird gadgets and trapdoors and all that kind of stuff, there would be a room with two buttons, both of them saying like self-destruct button, but one of the buttons just destroys the other self-destruct button. But then one of the buttons really does blow up the entire house.
Oh, you know, man.
It'll be a fun game for people.
That is crazy. You're a maniac.
I am. That's why I don't have money, because I would spend it. That's the only reason. Back to Rebecca, who has just fallen through a weak spot in the floor in the torture chamber earlier and escaped a bloodlusting baboon. She is now dangling over a giant abyss. As she fell, she grabbed a piece of metal jutting out over the edge. It's a long fall into the river below. She's able to radio Billy for help, who makes his way to Rebecca, but finds out there's more than one Eliminator baboon out on the prowl. He finds Rebecca in the sub-basement, and he locks onto her arms and lifts her up just in time.
My God, what a giant, gaping hole.
Ugh, something powerful had to have done this.
Well, thanks for saving me. Whatever's at the bottom sure does stink. The fumes almost caused me to pass out and let go.
Oh, I know. It truly is foul. Oh, God. Hey, what's that written in Sharpie over there on the wall next to the hole?
Oh, it says, Barry was spelled W-U-Z here.
Oh, man. Weird how that doesn't, like, match the timeline, considering this hole is here before Barry and the Alpha Team arrive.
I know, but we rely on Barry and his diarrhea for laughs, and the episode was getting dry.
Well, it's not dry now because there's a massive bubbling hot butt you at the bottom of that hole that you were dangling over.
Oh, man.
That hole might as well have been in the fourth wall, not the floor, you know, for a wonderful skit like that.
Wonderful. It's interesting to break the fourth wall in your own podcast, but we did it.
There's a certain amount of egotism that requires, and I'm glad we have that. After Billy saves her, the two agree to work together. Suddenly, Rebecca's radio picks up a transmission. It's Enrico Marini. He asks her if she's found Cohen yet, referring to Billy Cohen. Awkward, Rebecca responds while looking directly at Billy that no, she hasn't seen him, but, you know, she'll keep looking. Afterward, Billy and Rebecca share a moment where she tells him now that she's disobeyed orders. She's probably not going to have a career in law enforcement. It is her first mission, after all. She reconciles this by saying she probably won't live long enough to regret it anyway. Finally, she works up the courage and approaches Billy more solemnly and asks him if he really did murder 23 people. She says she won't judge him for it. She just needs to know the truth.
It's so silly to me.
Billy, I have a question. You promise you won't be mad?
Hey, ask away, little girl. What's the worst that could happen? It's just a question.
Well, did you do it?
Do what?
I promise I won't be mad. I don't even care, really. It's not a big deal, like, at all. It's not like I knew them or would ever go to their country or whatever, but did you murder those 23 innocent people? Billy, answer me!
Well, hold on, we're counting. It was 23 or not. Yeah, sure, we'll go with 23. Yeah.
You said you wouldn't judge.
After, I would have loved to if he would like divide about like innocent. Yeah, like probably most of them. After a brief pause, Billy tells her it was this time last year he and his unit were sent to the African jungle to wipe out a guerrilla forces hideout. Most of his company died in the heat or from enemies on the way to the hideout, and by the time they got there, there were only four of them left. Upon arriving at their target, they realized the entire mission was based on bad information. The guerrilla hideout was actually a village of innocent civilians. Billy's commander thought they had come too far to leave empty-handed and demanded his men kill every villager. Billy tried to talk him out of it, but his commander struck him with his gun and knocked him out. The commander continued to open fire. Eventually, Billy stops talking, and Rebecca asks for confirmation that his commander really did kill all those innocent people. Billy responds with, "That was then. This is now." She tells him that her teammates think he killed those military police who were transporting him in the van, but she admits that she doesn't think he did. She thinks they were killed by the zombie dogs. Billy says he either has to turn himself in or run forever.
Yeah, and the "that was then, this is now," like, I don't know if being mum and coy and cool about murdering a bunch of people is the right move here, dude.
Hey, he has one handcuff dangling from his wrist, all right?
That's true.
Like, he's set the bar for cool. He can say whatever he wants.
He just refuses to say no. It's like, "Hey, did you murder, have you murdered anyone ever?" And he's like, "You know, that was, you know, it, you know, birds fly high. Yeah. What does that mean? What are you, Pearl Jam? Say something."
In the second sub-basement, Rebecca and Billy find a large, heavy plate in the fireplace that looks like it would fit the control panel of the observatory. As they continue to look, they find the bottom sub-basement where there appears to be a large rat maze for zoology tests. To get a key, Billy must defeat a pair of vicious hunters in the maze's tight confines. He locates the key buried in a pile of human bones. The key leads to the next floor and out to the recreation areas. The leech-like zombies are back, and through experimenting with a Molotov cocktail, the team realizes their vulnerability to fire. Once they find everything they need for the observatory, they head to the control panel. Now, vulnerability to fire seems like maybe a step one sort of test. Like, fire is pretty deadly to most things, after all. And I'm wondering, did they test like a variety of things before eventually landing on fire? Like, okay, look, I know what you're thinking. Yes, I did try coating them with powdered sugar first, okay? I also did try dropping cotton candy on their heads, all right? Mm-hmm. Both the store brand and the name brand stuff.
Okay, yeah.
I also did crop dust them a few times, both dry and wet, okay? So it was more of a crop spray, but I did both. And of course, I did do the Carlton dance in front of them for 30 seconds.
Okay. Did you try fire?
No, of course not. I'm a man of science. I've got to start with the most obvious solutions and then work up to the crazy stuff. So anyway, before I was interrupted, I did try making fun of their weird walk. And I did try the Carlton dance again, this time for 40 seconds. See, that's called elevating the experiment. Are you writing this down? These are really good lessons for you. You should get all this.
He's just trying to get out of not taking the policy-required matches with him. Did you try the match? It's not that I forgot them. I just had a lot of cotton candy, and I had to poop. So that's why. But he couldn't admit that. No way.
Once the three plates are inserted, there's a rumbling. Rebecca and Billy look outside to see that the observatory has rotated, and the door they just came through now leads to a different balcony. Across the balcony is the chapel, but due to one person needing to stand on a floor plate for the door to remain open, only Billy enters. He admires the atrium for only a second before he's greeted by an enormous mutated bat. It takes some of Billy's most intense firepower to down the wicked creature. Billy then uses the hookshot from the train to rappel up to the chapel roof.
Yeah, do you think this whole sequence was a tribute to Batman? First, a giant bat comes down to greet him inside a gothic cathedral. Then he kills it, rappels to the roof with a hookshot. Seems kind of Batman to me. I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah. I also heard his parents are dead. He killed them.
Of course they
were one of the 23 people.
Of course.
But still, he's really leaning into this Batman thing. From the roof, Billy makes his way down to a switch where he can activate the elevator that Rebecca can access, and they can venture down beneath the chapel toward Dr. James Marcus's laboratory. Oh, sorry, laboratory.
There you go. There you go.
I already established in episode one that's how it's pronounced. Mm-hmm. In looking through his study, they stumble upon a door to a newly constructed cable car, but it needs parts before it can operate. So a newly kind of constructed cable car, Resident Evil, yeah. Partially constructed cable car.
Seriously, that also could have been on me and my writing, but yeah. We'll blame Resident Evil.
Well, I don't think anyone's going to give Resident Evil credit in their storytelling department.
To be fair, I think it was completely constructed and then some parts were missing afterward. Maybe they were stolen. That's what I'll say.
It's probably later in the script where they say that exact same thing, I'm sure. In searching for the parts, Rebecca finds an old photograph of someone celebrating a graduation. The inscription on the back is congratulating James on his graduation from university in 1939. I think that was before science was invented, so that explains a lot of his crazy experiments here. Rebecca decides that the man that's been stalking them and controlling the leeches must be Marcus's son or grandson. With the parts finally acquired, they meet back at the aerial cable car and Rebecca activates it. Just as they're about to board, an Eliminator jumps off the roof and attacks Billy. They both flip over the rail and plummet into the darkness. Rebecca rushes to the ledge to see if she can help Billy, but as she does, a leech zombie forms behind her. Its long, rubbery arms move to attack her. She flees and tries to restart the cable car once again. However, it appears the zombie sabotaged the cable car. She finally gets it moving along the tracks. To where? She does not know.
And this is where they should play Ozzy's Crazy Train. You know, just that first, like, 42 seconds, because after that, you're like, what the fuck is this song now?
What is this? No one's ever heard after the first 42 seconds.
It was it's like the crazy band was rocking out, and then someone's wife came home, and they switched.
I'd buy that. When the train eventually stops, Rebecca finds herself outside large metal warehouses that appear to be a loading zone for the train. There's a turntable in the center that allows for rail cars to be lifted and twisted, but this one has the secret feature of ascending hundreds of feet like a giant elevator. One of the sources for this episode, Thomas Wilde, by the way, he points out that 2 months from now, Claire and Leon will use this very same turntable to access Birkin's lab. That's fun. She eventually arrives at the top floor, but fallen rocks prevent her passage through, so she goes to a nearby elevator. But as she nears, the elevator dings and the doors open. She hides off to the side to see Enrico Marini step out. Confused on seeing Rebecca, Marini tells her that she should have seen the rest of the Bravo team come through ahead of him. He tells her that if they go straight from here toward the rocks blocking the way, they will reach the mansion where Umbrella is carrying out experiments. She tells him she'll catch up later. She's looking for Billy. Enrico tries to change her mind, assuring her Cohen won't make it out alive, but Rebecca insists. As he walks away, we hear Rebecca narrate,
"I never saw him again."
Referring to Enrico. Probably quite loud, right? Rebecca, what was that?
What was what, sir?
Oh, sorry. As I was walking away, I thought I heard you say something.
No, sir. I didn't realize I was speaking out loud. No worries, sir.
And that was the last time I ever saw her.
What was that, sir?
What? What was that? I want to do that in real life to someone. Just when I say goodbye to someone. And that was the last time I saw her.
Oh, that's amazing.
Nothing. If I told you, it would be a spoiler. So I'm not. Isn't it? Just go on living. Go on following your standard day-to-day path that you travel every single day. Just go ahead and keep doing that.
One time, though, you'll be right.
That's, and it'll well,
be,
you're right.
You'll be like, damn, that was great. Nailed it.
And then I'll be a suspect in some murder investigation. And it'll be really hard for me to tell. No. I've been pretending to murder him for years. So this is fine.
I just got lucky. I swear to God.
Yeah.
I'm so lucky he died today because of what I said.
No, I mean, unlucky. Unlucky. It's bad. Rebecca finds a key to a separate elevator by the rock fall and starts up. But something creeps up behind her from the fallen rubble. It stands tall, appearing as a man. Ugly, muscular, and one giant claw in each hand. One claw in the middle of the right hand is longer than the other, giving the creature a further unsettling appeal. To interject Thomas Wilde again, Albert Wesker will tell the other STARS members that this thing is a tyrant the very next day. Rebecca is standing, hopelessly waiting on the elevator she just called to let her in. The tyrant patiently leaps down to her and staggers forward before taking a large swipe at her with its enormous claw. She ducks out of the way, but tyrant manages to hit the call button on the elevator. The door opens and closes.
Her chance to escape is gone. With nowhere to run and nothing to lose, she unloads on the tyrant as it moves toward her. Eventually, it falls. The elevator arrives again, and Rebecca rushes onto it and heads to the fourth level. Since she hasn't been there yet, might as well try it out. That's game logic for you. As the elevator descends toward the fourth level, the camera once again zooms out to the perspective of the young robed man. Leeches cover the monitor he's spying on her with over the closed circuit camera. Speaking to himself, he declares that he is no longer amused by her or her friends. He ends saying that nothing will stop him from getting his revenge.
And nothing will stop me from getting my revenge. Oh, pizza must be here. Better get the door. Hello there.
Delivery for robed man?
That's me. How much I owe you?
$15.42.
Did you guys remember the banana peppers this time? I can't seek my revenge without banana peppers.
I just deliver it, sir.
Let me just peek under here to make sure, then. Wait a sec. There are no banana peppers on this.
Sir, I...
How am I gonna exact my revenge without the tang of a pickled pepper?
That's a perfect 80s cartoon villain voice.
Thank you.
You missed your calling there.
I know.
Of course, you were probably like, you know, 10 at the most.
Five.
Right? Five. See, there you go. Yeah. So, sorry, you just look way older than I thought you were.
You know,
so.
It's all this whiskey that I have to drink to deal with you.
I've been told that my company encourages people to drink whiskey. Rebecca exits the elevator, overlooking an aqueduct of raging water. Suddenly, Billy floats by, barely conscious but alive, hanging off a piece of debris carried by the current. Rebecca notices him and yells for him, but the water is too strong and he becomes dislodged from the debris, going under the surface and through a dark, unlit waterway beyond where Rebecca can see. She follows a walkway around to a control room in the darkness and is able to restore the power. Once the lights are back on, she's able to take a nearby elevator down and reaches an abandoned sewage treatment plant riddled with zombies and monsters. Eventually, she comes across Billy lying motionless on his back. She rushes to Billy, who immediately coughs up water and wakes up. She embraces him and tells him he's safe and asks if he's okay.
Well, I'm a little hungry, fatty.
He's mean. He's a mean guy.
He's a mean guy.
As she thinks they're sharing a tender moment, it appears Billy is distracted by something in the near distance.
A fatter... That chick's way fatter.
Sorry. Rebecca realizes and sees it too. It's a mass of bones and skeletons. Billy surmises it's test subjects from Marcus's research, presumably from some type of virus. Suddenly, Billy has a flashback to the African village littered with dead bodies.
Man, Billy is on point, but I guess after you murder a village, you kind of have a knack for determining cause of death?
We don't know if he murdered the village, remember. That was then. This is now. Rebecca and Billy work their way through the puzzle-laden factory before reaching the ninth floor, where they are found by Tyrant. As they walk along a balcony on an upper floor, one of Tyrant's giant claws is seen coming over the edge of the walkway. It hits with a clang that causes Rebecca and Billy to both startle. Tyrant climbs over the railing and slowly staggers toward them, nude, glistening, vile. Rebecca and Billy each unload on the monster with shotguns and magnums until it gives up and goes down.
Hmm.
I have a little issue with the nude part. This is Umbrella, very famously rich fictional company.
Mm-hmm.
We've had pants stretching technology in fiction since 1962 with the Incredible Hulk.
Oh.
Surely Umbrella could afford to put Bruce Banner on the payroll.
Yeah. I mean, that does make sense. Also, that sounds familiar. Like, wasn't Nude, Glistening, and Vile the name of that new Ted Bundy biopic with Zac Efron? I'm pretty sure that was the name of it. It was something like that.
I believe you. Is there really a Ted biopic?
Yeah, I think it's actually called New Glistening and Vile. I'll Google it.
I like how I just referred to him by his first name, too. Is there really a new Ted? Ted's got a new one, huh? That's cool. Good for him.
Yeah, he's killing it.
After solving a series of puzzles, Rebecca comes to a gondola, essentially a cable that allows a metal box to move through parts of the factory. She climbs inside to access a different side of the plant where she can raise the floodgate and allow water to exit the dam. Without the high water, Billy can now access a walkway across to reach Rebecca at the area near the plant's incinerator. Here they run into giant mutated insects that they quickly dispatch before moving to the inside of the incinerator. The incinerator hasn't been used for a while and is covered with pods of crawling leeches. Along a walkway above them walks out the man in the white robes.
He welcomes them to the party, as he says, since after all, it is their wake. He's clever.
Oh, wow.
Billy demands to know who the man is, and before their eyes, the man transforms his face from the young, long-haired man into an older, gray-haired man, and what is unmistakably the face of Dr. James Marcus. He says 10 years ago, Spencer had him assassinated by a machine gun. As he fell, he caught a fading glimpse of Wesker and Birkin, who, standing over him, mocked and told him not to worry, that they would take care of his research. He was then dumped into the water, which was to be his lasting grave. He goes on to say, here, something wondrous happened.
Wow, I wonder what that was. And real quick, typically, this is just me, an assassin uses very secretive, deliberate, or under-the-radar means of taking out their target. So a machine gun, the same weapon you would use to, I don't know, murder an entire village with? Like, I don't know. I don't buy that one.
It was a machine with a silencer, so it was just like...
Fair enough.
And you always see pictures of, like, Rambo yelling over his machine gun, right? Like, ugh! So he had to, like, yell really quietly, like... that's going to be really bad audio, but yeah, just imagine a dude stretching his face really big, but only a small sound comes out. Theater of the mind, people. Marcus explains that the Queen Leech, a specimen of a scientific research into the virus, found his dead body, crawled inside him, and began to spawn. The T-virus resurrected Marcus, a humanoid monster capable of shape-shifting and controlling his army of leeches. He exclaims that he has returned and the world will now burn an inferno of hate. Billy does not find this as humorous as Marcus does, who maniacally begins to laugh up until he starts vomiting leeches.
It takes a lot of Clamato for me to get to that point.
Clamato can do that to me with just the smell of it. Stuff is awful.
Yeah, it's gross.
Even he looks surprised by this, and within seconds he's transformed into a hideous and grotesque leech monster with giant tentacles spurting from its back and gaping cavities along its body, each filled with teeth as if the entire body consisted of several elongated and opened mouths. Billy and Rebecca don't think twice. As it leaps up to the ceiling and back down on them, vomiting all the while, they unload on him until Marcus's screaming voice fades to a dull whisper, and then to nothing.
Terrifying. Also, that Zac Efron movie is called Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Vile. So I was close.
You're very close.
Yeah.
You're a fan, I can tell.
Big fan
of Efron or Ted Bundy, I'm not sure.
Efron. What's his first name? Zeke?
Zeke Efron. Zeke Efron. Once dead, Marcus leaves behind two keys that Billy and Rebecca retrieve and use to open another door into the incinerator that leads to a freight elevator that gives them access to the fifth level, which was previously not reachable. As it ascends, the elevator starts to shake. Billy looks down and sees the Leech Queen, or what was once Marcus, now coming toward them. It now has four legs, has grown to the size of a tank, and looks a bit like a Demogorgon from Stranger Things.
Hmm.
The Leech Queen smashes into the elevator, causing it to tip over and launches Billy and Rebecca far across a wide open space fit for fighting Leech Queens.
Leech Queens. It'd be a great name for either a stoner band or an overachieving sex worker.
Why not both?
Could be both.
In what may be considered good timing, William Birkin has started that self-destruct timer he mentioned earlier, so Rebecca and Billy have 5 minutes to kill Marcus's monster and exit the facilities before they become leech food. The Queen shoots acid out and onto the floor around them, making it difficult to stay in one spot. Although a slow mover, the Queen proves strong as the barrage of gunfire appears to do nothing more than to slow the mutated monster. The vibrations and quakes of the relentless battle cause the shipping dock's retractable ceiling to separate only slightly, allowing some early morning sunlight to seep through. The Leech Queen appears to not take kindly to the light. Rebecca, noticing this, formulates a plan. Billy distracts the Queen while Rebecca attempts to open the ceiling the rest of the way.
Oh, video game logic. Like, our high-powered, hot, powerful, relentless gunfire is doing nothing. Oh, wait, but look, the lukewarm sun of which I long to bask in, as a baby kitten would, is miraculously murdering this mutated beast. Hurry, get the ceiling open more. I'll quit shooting. We're wasting bullets.
I would like it if Rebecca's, like, plan, because she doesn't really tell Billy. She's like, I got a plan. I'd love if her plan was, like, to close the ceiling and be like, yeah, I couldn't see either. It was blinding me. Okay, let's keep firing.
I'm going to eat you. It's what he would say.
Yeah, I can't wait to eat you. I think Billy and the Leech Queen should like end up together.
There you
they
go.
Could just eat Rebecca together.
They both suck.
That's true. It unfortunately takes several turns of a crank to complete the opening of the ceiling, but Billy is able to hold his own. Once open, the sunlight hits the queen, and she storms away, angry, and violently thrashes Billy and Rebecca across the room. Rebecca gets back to her feet and finds a heavy revolver that was hidden behind a stack of crates. She tosses it to Billy, who in slow motion catches it, takes aim, and fires at the queen. Luckily, there's an explosive round in the revolver that sears a hole in the queen, who then falls backward down the elevator shaft, where the flames of the self-destruct sequence explosion rush up to meet it.
Billy looks at the revolver puzzled. He empties the bullets from it. Written on the side of one of them, it says, "Sun bullet." And that gun, left there by God.
By the same logic, the Leech Queen was also left there by God, so...
That's true.
Yeah.
We're all just God's playthings.
That's true. Billy and Rebecca quickly flee and make it outside safely. They look back to see the Umbrella training facility completely engulfed in flames. They rest on a nearby hill and watch the facility continue to explode and crash apart. Exhausted, Billy takes off the handcuffs from his wrist and tosses them into the forest before falling to the ground.
Whoa, wait. He could take them off the whole time?
Well, I won't be needing my good luck handcuffs anymore. Thank God, those were uncomfortable.
What a badass. Jeez.
Standing on the hillside, Rebecca notices a mansion down in the trees about a mile or so away. She exclaims,
"That must be the mansion Enrico was talking about."
She rips Billy's dog tags from him and puts them around her neck. She says,
"I guess it's time to say goodbye. Officially, Lieutenant Billy Cohen is dead."
She salutes him. He salutes back, and she heads down the hill to meet up with the rest of her team at the mansion. Billy doesn't seem like a smart guy.
Wait a minute. I'm not dead.
Billy, I'm saying that's what I'll tell my people so they'll stop looking for you.
Okay, cool, man. Say, are you hungry yet?
No, I really don't have an appetite. This has all been quite upsetting.
Oh, man, bummer. I understand it, though. I mean, that's how I was feeling after murdering all those people.
Whoa. What? So you did?
No, sorry, I mean, after seeing all those people, not actually murdering those people, just seeing them, man, I'm just not myself when I'm hungry. I'm just tripping over my words here. Oh, man.
Okay.
Oh, Billy.
Billy thanks her as she walks away and gives her a thumbs up.
Behind her back. He gives her a thumbs up behind her back.
It's almost like he knew there was a camera there.
Yeah, you know? it's that, and also I think it's the game's nod of saying, like, yep, he's fucking stupid.
He's a stupid son of a bitch. Oh, man. That concludes the tale of Resident Evil Zero. But there are some lasting thoughts here, especially now that we know what happens next for Rebecca Chambers. After her appearance in the mansion in Resident Evil 1, we don't hear from her again in Resident Evils 2 or 3. In future episodes, we'll have to see if Rebecca resurfaces. Mm. Same for Billy. Mm-hmm. Although Rebecca officially reported him dead, according to a report found in Resident Evil 2.
Okay. Mm.
Yeah, so what are your final thoughts on this one?
I think if I had to, kind of calibrate it to the other ones, I think it's kind of a forgotten title. You don't hear, not a lot of people are wearing the Resident Evil Zero t-shirts out and about. It's usually 1 and 2. And, of course, we just got the remake of 3 that got reinvigorated. So I think it's kind of like the Resident Evil Zero, but of those first 4, I think it's kind of 4th in reputation. But I think I like it more than 3. I would put it 3rd for me overall, I think, of these first 4.
Yeah, I think in terms of story and just in terms of, like, fun and stuff, yeah, you're probably right. I find it more playable and a little bit more enjoyable to play. Mm-hmm. Maybe not necessarily a better game by any means than 1, 2, or 3, but I just find it more playable, at least than the older ones, the new remakes and things like that.
Sure.
Of course, surely more playable. But yeah, I think you're right. I think it was a little forgotten. And I wish Capcom would remake... I think I would like for them to remake 0 instead of what the rumor is 4.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think, I mean, I personally think 4's height as is. Of course, remake anything you want to. I think the more folks that can access these games, the better. I don't oppose any remake, but I think if you're going to do the next one? Why not make it Zero or some of the ones that mm-hmm. people are maybe, you know, a little less known, like Code Veronica or some of these other ones. But, you know,
yeah,
whatever.
Eventually, I'm sure they will. Capcom likes money and people will buy these remakes no matter what. I mean, that's just the
yeah.
honest truth.
Yeah, they keep knocking them out of the park. They're not mm-hmm. it's not like they're, you know, half-assing it and trying to cash in either. They're turning out some good stuff.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. You said this one probably be your third favorite. How what was the order of the others?
I think I got to go 1, 2, 0, 3 in terms of game, just playing the game. Actually, I had a lot of fun in the third episode, though. I think Nikolai might be one of my favorite characters to come out of this. but yeah, I think in terms of just playing the video games themselves, it would be third.
Yeah, I'm so unprofessional that all of the voices I've done have run together. And they all end up, so I was like, I can't think of a specific character or voice that I like the best. I do like Albert Wesker.
Yeah.
Just because that's an absurd voice to do. But,
yeah, no doubt.
But yeah, all of mine end up being either like Southern gruff, dumb idiot Keanu Reeves kind of gruff, or nerdy scientist.
Yeah, same.
But I guess that's all the characters in the game, too. That's basically the three archetypes. So I nailed it.
It was actually tough for me to settle on. Because I was thinking, like, should I make Rebecca kind of funny or whatever? But I was like, nah, I'll just have to I'll have to make it normal or else it just won't sound right. Because the only other female archetype voices I have are my mother. And I haven't smoked for 50 years, so that one's hard to pull off. Or Paula Dean. And I didn't think there were enough references to butter for me to sell that one. So,
yeah, but although I think your Rebecca here did have sort of a Nickelodeon actor's tinge at the end of every sentence kind of thing, like where you're specifically delivering it to someone, yeah. which made it really funny. So
fair yeah. enough. Yeah. So which main character has been your favorite? So we've always had the female character be our lead, and that's mainly because we thought that that's the better vehicle for the story. But gameplay wise, you seem to favor that as well. But between Jill, Claire, and Rebecca, do you sort of have a favorite, or are they just vehicles for the gameplay?
Yeah, I think they're, to me, they're more vehicles for the gameplay. I don't, all of their stories to me anyway kind of meld together, but that's also me speaking as an armchair fan at best. I'm definitely not a diehard, so diehards out there could probably rightly correct me on that, but they all kind of blend together. Really, all the characters kind of blend together for the most part in my head.
Yeah, same here, especially, I think the hero characters, you don't get... They usually have fairly bland personalities because they're supposed to be you.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you don't get a whole lot of flavor between them. I think Jill is probably the strongest character, and that's probably reflected in the lore because she reappears so often. But I guess she'd be my favorite. But of Jill, Claire, and Rebecca, you know, they're all basically the same.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about sidekick character for you?
We've had some favorite? Fun ones, man. We've had Barry, Billy, of course, this time. You know, who could forget Leon? And, of course, Carlos, classic Keanu Carlos. I think, all in all, I have to say Barry. He turncoats one time and then just plays it off immediately. Like, within 10 minutes, he's on the helicopter like, all right, I guess we're going home now. And they're like, whoa, you were just a few minutes ago, you were turning the whole thing upside down, you know?
And I think he's, in terms of the characters in the episode, like, I think he was the funnest to listen to, because, like, you know, it's low-hanging fruit to be able to bring everything back to, like, diarrhea and pooping,
right?
But it's also great fruit to bring it back to diarrhea and pooping, like, and Barry was an idiot who could do that really well, and I thought he was my favorite to listen to, I think, out of all the characters.
I mean, just trying to find an excuse, because the game never built one in, of why he was everywhere in the mansion that you ended up, but he wouldn't stay with you. It had to be, because he had it on Decker, and it was an emergency, and he was with this attractive young lady, Jill, and he didn't want to let her know that, you know, he had some issues with IBS, and so he just ran around a scary mansion on his own to hide it, trying to find a place to shit.
We've all been there.
We have. We absolutely have. All right, everyone. I guess that concludes our initial series of this podcast and our foray into the world of Resident Evil. We covered Resident Evil 0, 1, 2, and 3, and we'll revisit the series again someday soon. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast so that way when we do return in a few weeks with a new series, you'll know all about it. A lot of work goes into making these, so there is no set release schedule for Tales of the Lesser Medium.
And if you would be so kind to rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts, especially iTunes, that would help us out a ton. If you'd like to reach out to us, you can do so on Twitter. The show is at Tales Lesser, and individually I'm at Caleb J. Ross, and Travis over there is at Trav Plays Games.
That's right. You can also send us an angry email about anything we got wrong to polykillpodcast@gmail.com, and we'll be sure to send that straight to the trash can. And you can also check out our other podcasts we make over on polykill.com.
And we would like to thank our friend Brian Williams at Hokey Briz on Twitter for the backing tracks used in these episodes.
Yes, and once again, our intro and outro theme was lent to us by one of my favorite musicians ever, Brad Sucks, and he's not a leech queen either. check out his stuff on Spotify.
And thank you so much for listening.
And the tale has been told.